is made possible in part by a grant from Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois. Today's broadcast is made possible with support from these business partners: Human Kinetics Publishers Incorporated, Champaign; Devro TPAC, Danville; and Illinois Graphics Incorporated, Bloomington. These business partners join the Friends of WILL in making great programs possible. Thank you. Today's broadcast is made possible in part by a grant from Strawberry Fields in downtown Urbana. Strawberry Fields Catering Department now offers boxed lunches for professional meetings or casual lunchtime gatherings. Strawberry Fields, 328-1655.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 WILL Urbana. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for joining us today. Today, listeners, I welcome your questions for registered dietitian Susan Kundrat. Generally, Susan joins us on the first Monday of the month to talk about diet, nutrition, and exercise, but yesterday was a holiday, so we moved the topic to this afternoon, a Tuesday. To talk with Susan, all you need to do is give us a telephone call. The number's in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Susan is a sports and wellness nutritionist and the owner of Nutrition on the Move. She specializes in developing personalized nutrition plans for athletes and the general public. She's also a visiting dietitian with the Food Science and Human Nutrition Department at the University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign. She's also a frequent contributor to magazines on health and fitness. And you'll find her on the web at www.eatandmove.com. She also has an office at Strawberry Fields in Urbana. Questions about diet, nutrition, exercise, they are invited this afternoon. 333-9455, 800-222-9455. Welcome back. Good to see you.
Thank you. Good to see you.
And we've already got a couple of callers.
Okay.
Getting in line here. So let's go and talk with our first listener this afternoon. Line one, a listener on a cell phone. Hi.
Hi. How are you?
Good. Go ahead.
Good. I'm a nursing mother. I have an 8-month-old boy who we think is allergic to soy and dairy. So I've been trying to find out what can I safely eat that won't go into him. I've been losing lots of weight and haven't been able to get an answer as to what I can do to keep my caloric intake up while not putting him at further risk for allergies.
Sure. What are you doing right now in terms of the things that you are not eating?
For about 2 weeks, I completely eliminated dairy and soy, and that's when my weight plummeted. I've also eliminated peanuts, so my non-meat protein is absolutely nil, I guess. So that's what I've been doing, and his symptoms got better. I slowly started to introduce dairy, and it seemed to be okay. But I guess I'm trying to figure out what I can do besides adding more dairy to
right.
make my weight increase so that I'm healthy, too.
Right. Well, and that is a tricky one when you've got both milk products and soy for being in terms of the protein. The peanuts, too, that you're talking about, because one area is nuts and seeds and looking at trying to get some more. The good thing about those is they will give you a lot of calories, too, which you need. You're
right.
Probably losing out on calories as well as the protein. And really, unless you really think there's a problem with peanuts, it's generally not. I mean, I think this whole issue is not real clear in terms of whether to have peanuts or peanut butter or whatever when you're nursing or when you're pregnant and so on.
Okay.
But I don't believe there's been a huge, correlation that's actually been found with nuts. You may stay away from peanuts, but try to go with some other nuts. That might
okay.
be possible, too, because in terms of nut allergy, usually if there is a nut allergy, it usually is peanuts.
Right.
And so you may find that you can get almond butter or other cashew butter or, again, other nuts, certainly sunflower
okay.
seeds, things like that would be great because, again, they'll give you that protein plus they'll give you extra calories. The other thing that may be low that you might want to look at doing is even increasing what you're doing in terms of meats. Are you having
right.
Are you eating much in the way of meat or
fish? Yeah, well, I'm having to. I don't really like to that much, but I'm probably having one or two servings a day.
Yeah, which is great.
Okay.
Right now, that'll be really helpful as well. And the other thing I would be concerned about maybe is also calcium. So you might want to look at making sure you're having the, say, calcium-fortified orange juice or some calcium-fortified grain products and things like that, and maybe a supplement if you're not already doing that. Are you still taking a prenatal supplement, or are you?
Yeah.
And that's good to, of course, keep on that as well. But probably a lot of what you're not getting is basic calories. And so you need to look at ways I can get some more fat. And you might even, you know, you might even consider putting some flaxseed oil in something that you're even in muffins or something like that, or a lot of people just have a teaspoon of that a day too, in terms of getting some other essential fats.
You know, when I was in school, I had a friend. She and her husband went into the goat herding business, and goat's milk and goat's cheese, it turns out, are good for kids and who are dairy intolerant. So that might be another possibility to look into. And goat's cheese, I think, is yummy, and that would give you some calories for sure.
Right.
Okay.
That's a good point. And it may not be as high in protein, but you'll get a lot of other things out of there too. And that certainly there are some places around here that have that available as well. But I would go really heavy on other things like nuts and seeds, and even something you know, as simple as having you know, real granola for a snack and throwing in some extra nuts in that. And you could easily, in a cup of granola with extra nuts added, it could be 500 or 600 calories.
Okay.
And so it might be that you need to eat snacks anyway during the day, and making sure that those are a lot higher calorie things as well.
Okay. Thank you so much.
Okay. Thanks for the call this afternoon. And I suppose vitamin D. What are some other sources of vitamin D? Well, sunshine, but besides dairy is a huge carrier of vitamin D.
Exactly. Well, and of course, like you're saying, the vitamin D fortified. Sometimes you'll see vitamin D fortified in some other, even things like cereals now, more so
and
than
orange
we used
juice.
To. Yeah, and orange juice for sure. And other juices too. We always think orange juice, but now you get a lot of those fortification in other juices as well. And then certainly someone in her case would want to continue to probably take that prenatal that offers more of a lot of nutrients even after the baby's born when you're nursing, to be helpful with that too.
Smoothies maybe too?
Yeah, smoothies, you could make
with
the smoothies.
Some honey and...
Sure, you could put honey. The nice thing about smoothies is you can put something like the nut butters in there, like an almond butter. You could mix that up with banana. You could mix that up with, again, a lot of times you'll use a Carnation Instant Breakfast or something, but you wouldn't want to use that with a milk allergy either. But even that with fruit and throw that in there. A lot of people put the flax seeds in smoothies too, so that can be helpful as well.
How wheat germ, is that a caloric?
It's pretty
addition?
High in calories as well, and very high in B vitamins. And it also is a fairly good source of vitamin E, as well as the nuts and seeds. So that's real important too. And probably we're finding that's more important. These fatty acids are probably more important than we thought when you're nursing and when your child is real young.
Okay, let's talk with another listener. Caller in Urbana on line one. Hi.
Oh, hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
What is MSM and what are the pros and cons of it?
Well, MSM is a supplement that is often, mainly it's marketed to help with decreasing inflammation, joint inflammation. You'll often see that in combination with glucosamine or some type of joint type program in terms of a supplement program. And, you know, from what I know about MSM, it's not probably as well studied in terms of the real solid studies as glucosamine.
Okay.
And so often if people ask me, should I take one or the other if I want to try something? Generally, and most clinicians will recommend this too, generally trying glucosamine first to see if that will work for you. And even glucosamine with chondroitin or without, it's kind of questionable. Some studies find more benefit with chondroitin, some find without. So probably the beginning thing you might want to try is maybe something more like glucosamine itself. And MSM, again, you know, it's marketed for a lot of things, but I just haven't seen as much research on that.
Okay.
Are you mainly interested in the...
For arthritis.
Yeah, for arthritis usually. Now, one thing about glucosamine, you always want to... I mean, it's certainly a very popular over-the-counter supplement, but there have been some studies with glucosamine where it may affect blood sugars a little bit. And so you just want to be aware of that, that, you know, when you think glucosamine, you kind of think glucose, and it's partly related to a sugar substance. And there's some thought that it may change blood sugars a little bit. In fact, I had a client not that long ago who was a newly diagnosed diabetic, and she was taking glucosamine too. Mm-hmm. And that's potentially was increasing her blood sugars as well. And so, you know, you never know for sure if that's exactly what it was, but it was appropriate for her probably to go off that while she was trying to get her blood sugars under control.
Right.
And so it's something that you want to kind of make sure that is monitored, you know, with your physician and perhaps pharmacist as well.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Okay. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. If you'd like to talk to registered dietitian Susan Kundrat here on the Afternoon Magazine. Well, we are in high picnic season, mm-hmm. cookout season, and I know this is something that you suggested we talk about today, and that is keeping everybody safe around the picnic table.
That's right. When we think about being out and enjoying food and enjoying company, and particularly as it gets warmer, it hasn't been that hot this summer here at least, but it seems like it's leaning towards that way,
yeah.
That you really do want to watch what you're doing with your food and being smart about food in terms of food safety. And there really are some simple things we can do to try to prevent a foodborne illness. And as we were talking a little bit earlier, if you've ever had foodborne illness, if you've ever been really sick from it, it makes you be a little more careful about what you can do at least. You know, sometimes people get sick because a different food handler, they've been in a restaurant or whatnot. But many times people actually have problems because of what's been done at home that they might have prepared themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think there are some key things we can keep in mind that just as reminders are important to think about as far as what we can do. And probably the first one is definitely washing your hands. We say that all the time. And with kids around, I'm reminded of that more with a child in the household to wash your hands all the time. But just really simply to make sure that you're washing your hands. There are some people who recommend washing them to row, row, row your boat, because that's about how long you have to wash your hands, and making sure that you do use soap and that it's warm, soapy water. But washing more times during the day is one really helpful thing, because often we do prepare food when our hands are dirty. And even things as simple as if you have pets in the house and you might have been petting a pet right before you prepared food, and the pet might have been out rolling in who knows what, or, you know, there could be an easy way that you could transfer, but you don't
sure.
often think about that,
yeah.
that you might think, gosh, I washed my hands a half an hour ago,
yeah.
but your hands might not be that clean. So that's probably the most important thing. Another thing I see people do a lot, and maybe this is because I'm more in tune with it, but often I'll see people use a marinade with a meat. They might have a marinade for the meat going onto a grill, and then they kind of keep marinating the meat from that marinade, and some of that might get cooked off fine, but if you marinate it at the end of when you're cooking that meat, some of that marinade might have some raw meat still in it, and then things aren't getting cooked properly. So it's really important on a grill to be aware of continuing to use a food thermometer if you can, and try to make sure that what you're cooking on the grill is done. It's not real practical, but I think if you get used to having a food thermometer out there too, it's not that difficult.
Yeah, just
to
boil
use.
That marinade then once you
exactly.
put the meat on at the outset.
Right, to boil that too. And one a really good thing about a marinade is, this is kind of not along the food safety lines, but there are a lot of studies on marinades with meat, that if a meat is marinated, then there's much less chance of having more cancer-causing chemicals on the meat.
Mm.
You know, if the meat does get a little bit overly cooked, or we always say when you're barbecuing to try not to burn your meat, because the more burnt it is, and the more cancer-causing chemicals it's got in it. But if you marinate the meat first, then definitely that decreases the chance of that.
And you can also go with much leaner meat.
Exactly, and it can be tender.
Skinless chicken and lean cuts of pork and beef.
Right, right. So those are important things. Certainly one other thing to think about is to make sure that if you're using cutting boards, that you try to keep your cutting boards separate. We talked earlier about the idea of having different colored cutting boards. That's a great idea. For instance, you might have a yellow cutting board that's more for meat. You might have a green one that's more for vegetables. And you try to make sure that you're washing those really well, but you also keep those separate, and never cut vegetables on a cutting board that has had meat or fresh poultry or anything on it as well, because that certainly can transmit some bacteria or some other problems,
yeah.
too.
Also, you know, when the weather does turn really warm, probably, you know, the sort of the, that idea of the two-hour safety window doesn't work at all. I mean, stuff can get really wilty pretty quickly. So probably it might be a good idea just to put out smaller amounts of food, keep things in the refrigerator.
Exactly.
And getting back to the idea of the barbecue and the marinade, I know that this is something that I guess I really didn't think too much of. It's something I've always done, but the meat goes out on one platter. It should come in on a clean one.
Right, right. An easy way to get used to doing that is if you take the meat out on one, just always take out another plate or always have two plates so you don't have the temptation to just put it back on that plate when it's done, because definitely it's a very simple thing, but many people don't think of that, that you put it back on that plate and it's got some juices from the raw meat on it, and there could be your contamination right there. So, and I think we think a lot about meats perhaps, but also very simple things like, of course, a lot of summer salads will have mayonnaise in them, or they might have eggs in a potato salad, something like that, that it's really important to, like you said, bring that out when you're going to eat, take it back as soon as you're done eating. In terms of weight management, that's good because it's not sitting on the table, so we might not eat as much.
No grazing.
That's right. And so that's important. I think the other thing to think about, too, is even when you're eating out, I think in restaurants, they tend to, sometimes restaurants aren't kept as cool as they need to be, or even when you are eating out, just really remembering that if you go to a buffet, which is where a lot of foodborne illness, we find that that's linked many times to buffet lines, that you're real careful and you try to get the food that looks like it's the hottest in terms of being on the hot side, or if it's on the cold side, that I always tell my clients to dig way down in so you get the food that's closest to where the ice is hitting the actual salad, because that may make a big difference. If you get what's on top, that might have been exposed to air for a long time, depending upon how popular the item is. So things like that you can think of at home, too. Keep them cold as long as you can. Bring them out, put them back into the refrigerator, or even have a cooler sitting outside so you can put the food back in there quickly.
Sure. Yeah, and also look for recipes maybe that don't rely so heavily on mayonnaise and eggs.
Right.
More like an olive oil and a vinegar kind of a thing. This is the Afternoon Magazine, and Susan Kundrat is our guest here this afternoon on the program. She is a registered dietitian, a sports and wellness nutritionist, and the owner of Nutrition on the Move. Questions about diet, nutrition, and exercise are invited this afternoon. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll free, 800-222-9455. 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. And Susan has brought in a handout this afternoon about keeping the picnic area safe and food safety. And if you'd like, if you want a copy of this, well, send me a self-addressed stamped envelope to WILL Radio, Afternoon Magazine, 300 North Goodwin Avenue, Urbana, Illinois, 61801, and we'll send you a copy of this. 300 North Goodwin, Urbana, Illinois, 61801. Let's talk with another listener, a caller on line 4 in Bloomington. Hi.
Hi, how are you doing today?
Good, how are you?
Doing wonderful. Got a question. I'm taking a medication for, it's about diet, taking a medication for adult ADD, and it's basically similar, it's Adderall, which is basically an amphetamine, and I'm kind of a thinner person, and I exercise pretty regularly, and I'm trying to think of ways that I can, I guess, increase my caloric intake, because I've already noticed I've dropped a couple pounds, and my doctor I'm working with just told me to, you know, try to eat more, but a friend of mine recommended this, it's a protein shake from one of those nutrition stores, it's soy-based, but in one milkshake mixed with like skim milk or soy milk, you get about 25 to 30 grams of protein. And I was wondering if that was a good way to go, or if there might be other ways if I need to be balancing protein with carbohydrates.
Okay. That's a good question. I think there's the thought is there that if you do need to gain weight, that you probably want to add more protein in. And you may need to add some protein. That would be fine. But probably your best bet is to add a balance of protein and carbohydrate and fat. And so what you might even think about doing is if you wanted to use a package shake like the one you're talking about, or even simple things that you can get at the grocery store, something like, again, Carnation Instant Breakfast or some of these types of shakes that are probably less expensive but out there too, then what I would suggest is maybe mixing that with something with a little bit more fat along with protein, for instance, like peanut butter. We mentioned that earlier, peanut butter or almond butter, something like that, that is really pretty concentrated in calories. That would also give you some more protein, but give you some more monounsaturated fat. And then you could even add something to that, like ice cream or frozen ice milk or yogurt or anything like that, that you could actually boost this shake that might start out at 200 calories, for instance, up to about 600 very quickly. And so, but in, then you get a little bit more balance along with that, too.
Is it something that I should, like, do, like, in the morning and then maybe in the afternoon, but not in the late evening, like, before, like a couple hours before going to bed?
If it doesn't bother you before you go to bed, then you're fine. It, something that's a shake, that's a liquid, usually does not give people problems as long as they're, you know, it doesn't sit in their stomach for a long period of time. There's really no good research to say that if you eat a lot later at night, it's going to turn to fat versus being used as energy or build muscle or anything. So you don't need to worry about that. I would use it when it's most convenient so you can be consistent with it. The whole thing with gaining some weight is you really need to be consistent with that. There's really no miracle shake. What I would do during the day is I would be really mindful that whenever you're eating, you're drinking something with calories. You might normally have water, have milk. You might want to have 100% juices more often. Things like that that would give you some extra calories as well. And then keeping snacks with you. You know, we talked a little bit earlier about things like trail mix, that if you kept that with you, or even in the car, little bags of trail mix with some dried fruit, you're having that once a day, that's another 300 calories every day because you got a snack with you. And you're basing it mostly on whole food. And so that way you could easily get an extra 1,000 calories a day. And if you consistently do that, your body gets used to it and you can gradually hopefully gain some of the weight. But it doesn't have to be just protein.
Okay, great. Thank you very much. I appreciate that.
Okay, sure. Let's go and talk with a listener on line one in the LaSalle area. Good afternoon. Line Hello. One. Hi, go ahead.
Yes, I was wondering, do propane barbecues create as much carcinogens in the meat as, say, charcoal briquettes or charcoal?
I don't believe they do, actually. I think with charcoal, it's a little bit easier to really burn the meat in different areas a little bit faster, too. So I think with propane, you can often get a more even heating element there. So of course, unless you keep it on for long periods of time, you're probably not going to have a chance for it to burn as quickly as you might with the charcoal as well. You know, from what I understand, most of what happens is actually the chemical change in the meat. And so if you burn meat, whether you burn it on propane or with charcoal, then certainly you're burning that meat, that fat changes, and you have more of these cancer-causing chemicals that would be in the meat.
Oh, I see. Mm-hmm. I thought it had something to do with the petroleum that was putting together the briquettes and things like that. I thought that might be having an effect on it.
Well, certainly some of the chemicals that are in the briquettes can affect that as well. And so that's another element altogether. But part of it is the change that actually occurs with the meat, particularly a fatty meat, when that fat gets burned and some of those changes that occur there as well.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Next, we talk with a listener on line two in Champaign. Hi.
Hi. Something you just said really kind of caught my attention. You said that there's no research showing that if you eat late at night before you go to bed, that there's no that's not necessarily going to add to fat building. All of the things that I've seen in, say, like Prevention magazine, some of the muscle magazines, and so on, have said that if you eat late at night, that food is going to be more likely to be turned into fat than not. Can you maybe elaborate a little bit and kind of explain that?
Sure. I mean,
I'll listen offline.
Sure.
Part of what happens when we eat later, if someone needs the calories, their body's going to require the calories no matter what, particularly if you're trying to gain weight and you're active during the day, you're using that. You know, when our body gains weight, it's because kind of day after day, we've got a surplus, and then eventually your body is going to store that as body fat. So I guess the point I'm trying to make is it doesn't happen just that fast in that, yeah, you eat too much at night and then that doesn't get burned and then you start gaining body fat the next day or something like that. It's more day after day on a 24-hour period, you're just eating more than your body requires. And most people, if they're active, if they're trying to gain muscle mass, and of course I work with a lot of athletes, but if they're active, they're not generally going to gain much body fat. They eat late at night. It doesn't matter when they eat. They're going to actually build more muscle if they've got the extra calories to do it. certainly you'll see in a lot of fitness magazines or something like Prevention that if you're trying to watch your weight, you know, try to cut off when you're eating mm-hmm. later on at night, because often we might eat a lot of extra calories then. We might eat not being that aware of it. We might – those might be calories we just don't need. And so if you're not – you know, it might be that you're not even that hungry late at night. And so that's a good, certainly a good tactic to try to keep your weight at a good level or not eat extra calories, is maybe to cut that down late at night. So, but I've seen some studies that have actually prepared or compared when someone eats, and there's not the difference in the calories that you might gain or the fat you might gain, depending upon when it is not that great. That's not a huge factor. The biggest factor is just, are you eating too much no matter when it is during the day? If you're eating extra donut in the morning, that might be the problem that helps you gain weight rather than when you're eating it as much. Certainly when we're more active during the day, we tend to bump our metabolism up a little bit more and perhaps burn a little bit more, but you can certainly be more active later and not be eating, and that'll help you lose weight too. So if you think of it in those terms, your body takes a lot longer to actually deposit fat than just eating late at night and then finding that you're not burning as much over the night, and then you're starting to gain weight.
Okay, let's talk with another listener. Caller in Chicago on line four. Hi.
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 Good afternoon. Does anybody make a listing of breakfast cereals as far as nutrition is concerned? There's so many of them, and most of them have sugar or something, bran or corn. But how does one tell one apart, and do you mention brand names?
Mm-hmm. Well, there are listings of cereals where they'll compare them. One organization that does this is Center for Science in the Public Interest, and they have a newsletter called Nutrition Action Health Letter.
All right.
And if you're online, you can just Google that, but Center for Science in the Public Interest or Nutrition Action Health Letter. I don't have the exact website here, but they do a really nice job of every issue. They analyze some type of food. Maybe it's breakfast cereals, or maybe it's donuts, or maybe it's something, and they try to give you an idea of what they call their best bets and best picks and things like that. And so they have a lot of information online, actually, from their past newsletters. So if you do get a chance to get online, you might want to just first check through them to see if you can put in breakfast cereals and what would come up. And there are also some other websites that do this kind of thing. One that comes to mind, I think you would be able to find this on here, is just one that's www.fatcalories, all together, FATCALORIES. I believe that's .com. And
Does Consumers Report rate them?
I don't know the last time I saw cereals in there, but I'm sure they do rate cereals along with other foods as well. And so that might be something to check even at the library and see. Actually, a lot of local libraries will carry this Nutrition Action Health Letter too. There are other nutrition newsletters that will periodically review cereals as well.
And that would mention the brand names, so mm-hmm. you don't have to read every box in the supermarket.
Right. They would have the brand names in there, too. And a good, I mean, depending upon what you're looking for, and this does take a little bit more time, but, you know, depending upon what you're looking for, now it's on the label, it is easier to find. You know, you see more cereals that are listing fiber and the breakdown of types of fiber and things like that, and there are a lot more cereals, I think, now, even compared to 3 or 4 years ago, to choose from that are much healthier options that really are a little bit higher in protein if you want that, higher in fiber.
You know what else might be a good shortcut is the Women, Infants, and Children program. Sometimes the supermarkets will, you know, mark that product WIC approved, and generally that means less sugar.
Mm-hmm.
So, for instance, I don't think sugar frosted flakes are WIC approved. But Raisin Bran, I would imagine, would be.
Well, bran has no food value. They claim it's mostly bulk. And corn, sort of the same thing.
Well, all of these, many of these cereals also are fortified now, so that's something also to take a look into.
Right, right.
All right, then, thank you.
Okay, hope that helps. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. No one waiting at the moment to talk to registered dietitian Susan Kundrat. This is a program we do once a month, generally on the first Monday of the month, but today, because yesterday was a holiday, we're talking about diet and nutrition and exercise with Susan this afternoon. Yesterday was a holiday, so we moved the topic to this afternoon, Tuesday. Anything in the news in terms of nutrition in the news that has caught your attention recently?
Well, there have been some interesting things. And one thing I might comment, we had the caller who asked about the soy protein shake. Mm-hmm. And some of the work that I've done at the university has been with the functional foods program or a grant that I'm working on through the USDA where we're looking at particular foods and disease prevention. And one thing that I'm trying to review right now is really the research out there on soy and cancer, which is tricky because there's a lot of different research from different angles and whether it promotes cancer or helps prevent cancer and so on, and it depends on the different type of cancer. But there was some general recommendations that have kind of come out in the last few months. There was a study by Bill Helfrich and his group here at the University of Illinois where they looked at, and this was in mice, but they looked at soy and compared soy flour with, then they had different products that were broken down from soy flour, made from soy flour. And kind of as a general outcome of this study, what he found was the more refined the product was, for instance, when you would break the actual soy flour and when you finally got the isoflavones or these phytoestrogens out of it, that tended to be the type of food fed the mice that tended to increase the incidence of potential cancer, at least in these animals. Of course, it's an animal study. So I've gotten a lot of questions about that study and about, in general, if you're using soy, this caller said, well, maybe 20 to 25 grams of protein, would that be all soy protein? Would it not? Mm. You know, our recommendation for soy protein amount for reduction of heart disease is 25 grams a day. The question still is out there, should that be from actual soy products like soy milk and tofu and miso and things like that? Or what happens when you just have soy flour or when you just have soy protein that's been extracted from mm-hmm. soybeans and things like that? And so it's been a big area of confusion, and partly with some of these new studies finding that, boy, maybe if the soy food is the least refined, that might be better. I think right now there's still a lot we don't know. But people have been asking that question a lot. In general, what we are finding is what we've been telling people, which is certainly soy appears to be healthy, particularly in moderate amounts, which might be one or two servings a day, maybe a glass of soy milk and half a cup of tofu or something, and probably more so in its natural form. But we really don't know, for instance, if something is made into soy protein isolate, is that going to be different from protein powder? That might be different mm-hmm. from what we do know probably is when you take the isoflavones, which are these phytoestrogens, and you have those in large quantities, whether that's in a supplement in very large quantities or take those out, that's probably what we need to focus on that could have potential concern for the most part. And so, for instance, this caller who said, you know, take a soy protein shake, what might be typical with somebody, they might take one, then they might take two a day, then three, and find out that he's getting 75 grams of soy protein. We have no idea if that's healthy or not, because what we do know is, again, typical Asian intake might be one to two servings a day, which might be 10 grams of soy, 15 grams of soy protein. And I think that's probably the area of caution that people need to think if something's working for them, don't automatically just take more of anything. It doesn't necessarily just relate to soy.
Yeah, right. Well, stay tuned on that. That's
right.
A really interesting area of research. And moderation in all things.
Exactly.
And I guess, you know, the things that Mother Nature provides us just on her own,
right?
You know, might be the also kind of for right now, mm-hmm. maybe the best thing we can.
Exactly.
We can do. Let's talk with some more listeners. Next, we're going to go to a caller on line one in Champaign. Hi. Nope. Okay, let's try line two, listener in Champaign. Hi.
Hi. You might have already touched on this, but I'm interested in trying to bring down my cholesterol level without using medication. Could you talk a little bit about how that would happen? And also, what do partially
hydrogenated.
Yeah.
There you go. Those oils, how do they affect the cholesterol level?
Sure.
Okay.
That's a good question. Well, let me start with what really seems to increase blood cholesterol levels the most. And those tend to be foods that are very high in what we call naturally saturated fat, which would be something like the fat that you would see on the steak. If you see a nice steak that's a very tender steak, often it'll be marbled, but you also might see that white fat on the outside. That's considered saturated fat or very hard fat. It's hard when you look at it at room temperature. And when you think about that, that's probably hard on your arteries after you eat that too. And so some fat is naturally high in the saturated fat. That might come from meats. That might come from other fatty foods. That might come from even things like cakes and cookies and things that might have this hard fat in it. And then we have something that's called partially hydrogenated fat, or fat that maybe started out as liquid oil and then they hydrogenate it. When they talk about hydrogenated fat, it's more fat that they've taken liquid, they've made it more solid, they've made it harder so that it will be, it'll stand up okay in food products and it'll keep things a little bit harder or have more substance to it. So those might be things that you find in any kind of food product like cookies or crackers or chips or ice cream or breads or rolls or muffins or anything like that. And so when you look at partially hydrogenated fat, that's what they've done to it. They've kind of changed the structure. When it becomes hydrogenated, again, it's more apt to raise your blood cholesterol levels. So when we look at things that they say they've taken the partially hydrogenated fat out, or another kind of term for that that's a little bit different but similar is trans fat. When you hear trans fat, trans fat tends to be the type that is more saturated and could increase your blood cholesterol levels more. So there's a big push to take out as much of this hydrogenated fat as possible from products, but it makes products more stable. And so there's a kind of a catch-22 on that. So if you look at these hydrogenated oils, they might be oils that are more solid-like oils. And so that's why they tend to raise your blood cholesterol more. So usually when people eat more natural foods, certainly they eat more fruits and vegetables and whole grains and things like that, they're probably going to get less of this hydrogenated fat because it's not naturally found in a lot of foods. It's more in these processed foods. So if you're looking to decrease your blood cholesterol levels, one thing you want to think about is, where am I getting the fat in my diet? The best way to do that is to even just write down everything you're eating for several days. Hopefully maybe have that analyzed by a dietitian if you haven't already. I think when you're looking at trying to decrease your blood cholesterol levels on your own, you want to make a really serious effort at it. You may have a physician who says, I'm going to give you 2 months or 3 months or 4 months and let's see what you can do with diet alone. You want to be serious about it, because if you can avoid going on cholesterol-lowering medications, then you want to, for sure, if you can do that. So you want to take a close look at that and see, am I getting a lot of foods that are fried? Am I getting a lot of extra fat? Am I eating lean meats when I'm eating meat? All these things could make an effect on your blood cholesterol levels. And then the other part of it is, you want to look at, what am I adding to my diet to help decrease blood cholesterol? Those might be things like oats. They might be things like gummy fiber. Again, oats and barley and beans, any kind of beans have sort of this type of fiber that may help decrease blood cholesterol levels. Many people, if they're using things like margarines, they'll use things like Benecol or Take Control, or even in orange juice now. You can buy orange juice that has these stanol or sterol esters in them. And that definitely has been proven to lower blood cholesterol levels in many patients. And so that's a simple thing. You can buy that orange juice.
Orange juice that's labeled health, heart healthy?
Right. There are different types. There are some that are just heart health that have extra vitamin C and things in them. There are others that will list that they have stanol or sterol esters added to them. And that's the one you'd want to get that may help with the same thing as Benecol or Take Control, that kind of thing.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. What about, does exercise play a role in cholesterol?
Sure it does. And so obviously getting on a really sound exercise program that includes aerobic exercise, not just strength training, but often aerobic exercise can help bring down cholesterol levels, and that's one thing that might increase good cholesterol, or HDL, is aerobic exercise. And so that's a really important part of it. And I think when you look at your risk factors for heart disease, cholesterol is one of them. You want to look at everything else. If you're exercising well, if you're eating well, and your cholesterol is still a little high, maybe you won't need to go on those. But, here's an example. I had a client not that long ago who tried to get cholesterol levels down by diet. She wasn't able to. Before she went on the medication, she went on Lipitor or Mevacor. Before she went on that, her total cholesterol was 255, which is pretty high. Her LDL was 169, which is very high. It was pretty high risk. And she did things with diet, didn't see a lot of change with diet, went on the medications, and her total cholesterol went from 255 to 160, and her LDL went down to 80. So really changes that she, for her particular person, could not have done with diet. I mean, the medication really has made a good impact, a great impact in terms of. So sometimes the medication is really the way someone's going to need to go, because it does decrease your risk a lot, and sometimes it's a combination. We know that once you're on the medication, if you follow a heart healthy diet and you monitor these things and add some fibers, you're probably going to keep it lower than if you didn't still. So you still want to keep an eye on that. But
okay, let's talk with another listener. Caller in Urbana on line three. Hi.
Hello. Susan, do you know anything about this supplement that's used in a lot of the catalogs for an anti-aging thing called noni fruit or Morinda citrifolia? It's the fruit of an evergreen that's grown in the South Pacific in the tropical belt. And it's a pretty hot item with all the vitamin shops and all that. And apparently it raises the proxerine level in the body. And it's real popular. I just wondered if you knew anything about it. Thank you. I'll hang up and listen.
Okay.
Well, this noni fruit or noni juice, I think I first heard about this about 10 years ago when a hairdresser I was with, she asked me about it, and that it was being very popular at that time around kind of the hairdressing circles and everything. And unless there are new studies out that I've not seen, which is possible, I have seen it reviewed several different places, and that many of the claims that it, you know, supposedly things that it supposedly does, there's questionable evidence behind that. Well, does this really happen? Does it really do these things that it's purported to do? So I'd have to say that my most recent information on this is questionable whether it's as great as it sounds. Of course, you know, anything that really sounds to be this miracle fruit or miracle type thing, you'd have to be a little leery of, because it's questionable, of course, whether it can do all those things. But you know, you see a lot of articles and a lot of reviews about anti-aging. What really does help us so that we don't age as fast? And we do know that foods that have more antioxidants certainly can play a role with that. And this fruit in particular, certainly I know it has antioxidants in it. Now, whether it's tons better than blueberries or something else, I would be surprised if it would be. But there's always that potential. But I've not actually seen a lot of good clinical studies to say that, yes, this is a miracle fruit or miracle juice. And from what I've seen, too, it's pretty expensive as well. And so, you know, I think if somebody's looking at for anti-aging properties or just looking to enhance their diet with more powerful antioxidants, we did have a new study that recently came out within the last 3 or 4 weeks that actually the fruits and vegetables that it really that came up as some of the highest were things like different types of beans and berries. And we always hear a lot about berries, but this kind of reinforced. I think berries were, 3 or 4 kinds of berries were in the top 10 in terms of really the potential as antioxidants to work to help keep your body strong and help repair tissues in your body. And I don't recall this probably wasn't tested. I don't know if it was, but I don't recall it in there.
Okay. Let's talk with another listener. Caller on line one in Champaign. Hi.
Hi. This is just a quick question, and I don't have a lot of information on it, but it seems to me there was a brief article in the Chicago Tribune just in the last couple of weeks indicating that vitamin C, just ordinary ascorbic acid, was not very beneficial and possibly even damaging for people with osteoarthritis. And I just wondered if Susan had any experience or further knowledge. I'll just hang up and listen.
Okay.
Thanks so much.
Sure.
Boy, and I don't recall that article specifically. You know, what in terms of vitamin C and osteoarthritis, you know, it's not a vitamin we generally think of as being really key to helping with bone health. Certainly it's important in general sense, but not large amounts. But I did not see that. My caution would be in terms of vitamin C is generally when people eat a pretty healthy diet and they're trying to include you know, the recommendation of 3 or 4 fruits and 3 or 4 vegetables a day, usually you can double or triple your vitamin C intake compared to the recommended amount of, say, 75 grams or milligrams or 90 milligrams a day. Usually you can double that or triple that easily by eating well. And that's a good way to get some extra vitamin C, but then you're not getting, even if you take a multivitamin and you have another 100%, you're not going way overboard with a lot of extra vitamin C, but you're getting more than the recommended amount, which might give you some extra benefit. But a lot of people take a whole lot of vitamin C thinking that it's going to be, again, another maybe miracle supplement. And maybe the idea, and again, we'll have to find this actual study, but maybe the idea is really focus on it from food, but let's be careful about that one too. It is water soluble, so sometimes people think, well, I'll just get rid of the rest of it in my urine, whatever I don't need. But we are finding that even some of these water soluble vitamins might have the potential to cause some problem if they're in very large amounts. I'm not sure what the amount was on this in terms of how much was taken.
We got to wrap it up here, but before we go, how often does the government look at, reconsider RDA?
Well, now they're on actually a pretty good roll because they're periodically looking at different groups. And so we've got a lot of new recommendations out in the last 3 or 4 years. And I think the idea from the government is to continue to periodically look at these. And instead of having recommendations for everything come out at once, they're looking at different groups of nutrients so they can continue to review the research and hopefully at least every 10 years have new recommendations coming out.
It also looks like they're also giving us more information about different demographic groups, which
right.
is also helpful.
Exactly.
Well, there's where we have to leave it. We've used up the time. We've even gone a little past time. Registered dietitian Susan Kundrat, are you going to be back in August?
Yes, I
okay,
will be.
Very good. First Monday in August, Susan will be back with us. She's a sports and wellness nutritionist and owner of Nutrition on the Move. You'll find her on the web at www.eatandmove.com. That's EatandMove. It's 8 minutes before 2 o'clock. Settlement prices should be in from the Chicago Board of Trade. Here's Dave Dickey.
Indeed they are, Celeste, and spreading was the name of the game today on the Chicago Board of Trade, particularly in the soybean as well as the soybean meal pits and the wheat corn pits as well, people buying the wheat and selling the corn. Let's get to the specifics. July wheat had a high on the day, a 340, a low of 331, settling 338.5, up 3.5. September, a high of 345.5, a low of 338.5, settling 344.75, up 3.25. December, a high of 357.75, a low of 351.5, settling 357.25, up 3.25. March, a high of 368.25, a low of 362, settling 368, up 5.5. And the May contract, a high of 372.5, a low of 367, settling 371.5, up 6 on the day. July corn, a high of 253, a low of 249, settling 249.5, down 5.75. September, a high of 257, a low of 252.5, settling 254, down 5.25. December, a high of 261.5, a low of 256.75, settling 258.5, down 4.5. March, a high of 268.5, a low of 264.5, settling 266, down 4. May, a high of 273.5, a low of 270, settling 271.5, down 3.75. July, a high of 276.75, a low of 273.5, settling 274.25, down 4.25 on the day. July oats had a high of 136, a low of 132, settling 134, up 2.75. September, a high of 140.5, a low of 135.25, settling 138.5, up 3.25. July soybeans, a high of 984, a low of 944, settling 979.5, up 40. August, a high of 829.5, a low of 809, settling 819.5, up 10.25. September, a high of 687, a low of 679, settling 684, down 4.75. November, a high of 653, a low of 642.5, settling 652, down 0.25. January, a high of 655, a low of 647, settling at 653.5, down 4. March, a high of 657, a low of 648, settling 657, down a half on the day. July soybean meal, the big mover on the day, a high of 345, a low of 316.60, settling 344.70, up 30.5. August, a high of 295.50, a low of 282, settling 294.70, up 14.90. July soybean oil, a high of 29.10, a low of 28.55, settling 29.05, up 25. August, a high of 28.28, a low of 27.67, settling 28.20, up 30 on the day. The settlement prices are also in on the Chicago Mercantile Exchange, where Celeste, we went limit up on the opening bell on feeders, and we just stayed there all day.
Yep, and meantime, lean hog prices dipped today. Let's take a look at those cattle prices first this afternoon. August feeder cattle, 111.40, the high. As Dave mentioned, they opened up, limit up, and that's where they hung in today. So let's take a look at this number. The top one, August feeder cattle, opened limit up, up $3, and that opened and closed at 111.40. September feeder cattle, 110.80 the high, 110.50 the low, 110.80 the settlement, that up the limit. October feeder cattle, 108.97 and a half the high, 108.70 the low, 108.97 and a half the settlement, that up the limit, up 300 points, $3. July live cattle, 90.10 the high, 88 even the low, 88.10 the settlement, that up $1. August live cattle, 88.25 the high, 86.95 the low, 87.62 and a half the settlement, that up 230. October live cattle, 89.10 the high, 88.20 the low, 88.87 and a half the settlement, that up 247 and a half. July lean hog, 79.47 and a half the high, 78.75 the low, the settlement 79.37 and a half, that up 25. August, 77.25 the high, 76.42 and a half the low, the settlement 76.65, that down 27 and a half. October lean hog, 67.20 the high, 66.60 the low, 66.95 the settlement, that down 20. December lean hog, 62.15 the high, 61.65 the low, 61.90 the low, and that was down a nickel. July pork bellies, 114.40 the high, 112.30 the low, 114.20 the settlement, that finishing up 175. The Dow down 78 points at 10,205. The NASDAQ is off 45 points at 1962. The S&P 500 down 11 points at 1115.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from the Illinois Farm Bureau and IFB's AgriVisor Market Advisory Service. AgriVisor offers market information and advice on the web to Illinois and Indiana Farm Bureau members at agrivisor.com.
It's time once again to Ask Dr. Science. So let's ask Dr. Science.
That's me.
Remember, he knows more than you do.
That's right.
Sue Neff from Missoula, Montana writes, Dear Dr. Science, is there a gene missing in men's ear canals that gives them selective hearing?
Yeah, you could say that. That particular gene resides in the ear, nose, and throat chromosome. Also suppresses emotive speech. When a man suspects that a woman wants to talk about their relationship, this gene literally takes over the autonomic nervous system.